And we've seen a lot of vaccine inequity globally. I work as a global health physician, and so I always scrutinize some of these decisions. With that being said, I want to look to the actual primary data and analyze that for myself. So when we do have access to that data, we hope to see it. And you know, there's a lot of us looking at this very closely. And so I hope the science is what guides this, not the the financial aspects.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Abrar Karan, fellow at Stanford University in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Geographic Medicine. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. It's 7:59 a.m., time for Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Go to help if I turn my microphone on. Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. I am the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio every week from 8 to 9 a.m., which is the time now, as you know. And I'm not the only host today. I've also got my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. I'm in the studio, and Jacqueline is on the phone from her house. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Hey, Paul.
So, as usual, there's quite a lot to talk about. I know you wanted to. There's a number of subjects. I know you wanted to touch on the heat wave and climate change, which I've been hitting. Gosh, the past three shows on my own.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which deserves even more talk. But anyway, go ahead. What did
The New York Times is reporting today that the Bootleg fire in Oregon is among more than 60 wildfires in the U.S., and that it's the largest fire in the country, burning over 200,000 acres. So, it's quite, and this for that region, of course, in the last show I was on last month, we talked about the Klamath River Basin and the fight over the water that's going on right now in the midst of a drought season. So mostly white farmers and ranchers are upset because the water has been, because of the drought conditions, it was announced that the water would be turned off for them. And so they are facing a pretty rough season. And then two of the farmers had purchased land next to the valve that controls the water, and we were threatening to sort of do what they did in 2011, which is go and turn it on manually. And of course, they'd gotten support from Ammon Bundy and his Patriot Militia group in Idaho. And of course, Ammon Bundy is running for governor of Idaho, like his brother Ryan Bundy had run for governor in Nevada. And so it's a really inflammatory situation in more than, obviously with the burning and the drought conditions, but also with the same things between different stakeholders in the region, including tribes who have senior water rights and are becoming targets of hate there. And so it's quite a lot to unpack.
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting when we had that program and had a lot of really interesting callers and brought up a lot of stuff that I certainly hadn't known nearly enough about. And some people helped kind of fill in and ask some really provocative questions about, you know, about the nature of the irrigation going on. And anyway, since then, I've done some reading, and OPB, actually, the Think Out Loud program, has done some really excellent the last two shows. I guess they're going to have a third show talking to the irrigators today, which will be interesting. But I learned even more that just that history, that Klamath Irrigation Project is just such a huge example of, you know, not just settler colonialism, but settler colonialism arrogance and absolute ignorance about how, you know, it's something you've talked about a lot, how the land works, how things actually operate, and how to live within the land, and that's still playing out tragically today.
Yeah, I mean, this is the legacy of the Bureau of Reclamation, and which I've been doing a lot of research on, particularly around, you know, what's happening at Lake Mead, which is also adjacent to Clive and Bundy's ranch there, and is within his cattle have been grazing there illegally on public land. And of course, that is going down. And what's happening, and how the Colorado River was allocated as well. I have a personal interest because my mom's family are from near the south rim of the Grand Canyon on the Navajo Nation, and have ranched there for over 100 years. And of course, you know, we are impacted by that sort of misallocation of water. And it's impacting the entire region. You know, of course, these places made the growth possible that we've seen in the last 100 years, whether you're talking about Los Angeles or Las Vegas or Phoenix or here, you know, where Klamath, where these white farmers were promised a certain amount of water with this large federal project that was built there to dam the water with no thought given to pre-existing water rights.
Yeah, the water rights issue is over the decades has been a huge point of contention in Indian country all over, because the same similar dynamics. You'll have, you know, people who will be, as you well know, you know, that may be flooded out by a dam project and then don't even get any benefit from the irrigation water from the behind the dam, things like that.
Oh, yeah. Little story. My dad, of course, is Yankton Sioux, Dakota, and his reservation, South Dakota. My great grandparents, farm there along the Missouri River was flooded by the Fort Randall Dam to create Lake Francis Case, and it was a part of a series of dams that were built along the Missouri River that flooded primarily Indian farmers on lands after they forced us to become farmers. And they went and flooded our best river bottom land and put us underwater because they didn't want to take the political heat from putting a white farmer's land underwater. But they still built these five dams. Of course, famously, Lake Oahu up in near Standing Rock, that was, of course, one of those five dams there. After what happened with the Tennessee Valley Authority and the big pushback they got there, the only way they could get the bill passed to fund those dams was to basically decide that Native voters were not such a big constituency to piss off, and so they went ahead and flooded all our land. And so this has impacted Native communities' ability to, you know, provide for themselves and to to be able to live on the land. I mean, my mother's family, ranching is really difficult in the desert. The ranch is actually in the Painted Desert. And of course, having the water you can have water rights. Another article I've been working on is I'm a Native journalist, so I cover a lot of issues, particularly having to do with environmental resource issues for tribes. One bit of good news coming from Indian country is that reportedly, Native Americans have the highest vaccination rates in the world.
Hmm.
So Native people really took the science seriously and actively worked to protect our most vulnerable population, our elders, and our cult, who are our cultural culture carriers and also our language carriers. And so, I did a whole series of podcasts during the pandemic, really going into a lot of these different struggles in detail from across the country with Native people. I got a grant from KBOO to sort of put some of those into a retrospective of the year. So I'm working on that as well. But I've been working on a piece looking at particularly the allocation of land for the Ute water settlement in Colorado, and it's pretty crazy. I mean, you have to really realize these water projects are huge infrastructure projects. They're some of the biggest infrastructure projects that the federal government has funded over the years, whether you're talking about the Central Arizona Project, which basically led to the growth of Phoenix and Las Vegas and Tucson, and the taking of that water from Native farmers, Native communities, and of course the strip mining of coal to power those cities with the incredibly polluting power plants like the Four Corners power plant and the Navajo Generating Station, which are all shut down now, but still have left behind a huge sort of environmental catastrophe, including a huge methane cloud that can be seen from space over the Four Corners area, which impacts all the tribes that live there and all the people that live there, and which is a big part of the Navajo Nation itself. They've left the largest Native nation in the country, with 370,000 citizens, have left us with a huge burdened us with huge environmental a price to pay for the development of the West in the 20th century, and with these strip mines, with this methane cloud still hanging over us, and of course the uranium mining, which was done to began during World War II as part of the Manhattan Project to build the bomb to win the war, and has left the atomic legacy of radiation. It is a poison pill that's been put on the Navajo Nation to stymie growth, and so it's always access to actually in exercising rights, right, and the will to do so. So the Ute tribes got this huge water settlement in Colorado, but they have not received a lot of. I was looking through the Ute Mountain Ute tribe and Lake Nighthorse, which was a huge. It's a lake that was built near Durango to pump up river to hold water from I think the Animas River, but there was no money put into the bill to basically pipe that water to the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. And so what has happened with all that water that's sitting there in the lake evaporating is that now it's just used for recreational use for boating, right? And so all these projects, they're not well thought out, and it was just a way to settle the Ute water rights, but then not give them any access to the water they supposedly have rights to. And so, these water across the West is over-allocated. It's been that way since the beginning of the American experience. It's even been that way, historically, when you look at these ancient Pueblo villages and sites, which were abandoned because of climate change happening locally, and so there is in Native communities sort of a cultural memory of how to live on the land and from real experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I really recommend that. Getting back to the Klamath, which it's a not just closer to us than some of these other cases, but is just really a really incredible case in point. And as you were mentioning, with the political aspect of it, it's a real flashpoint. Not just for Oregon, but nationally, it's gaining a lot of attention, and it'll be the way it gets resolved will be, if ever, and it will be a real, possibly a case study, and perhaps some form of historical justice and sanity, we hope. But I just want to give a shout out to Dave Miller with that Think Out Loud program. I listen to him fairly often. I think he does a really, really good job. I'm not always totally in agreement with his approach And but I think he's one of the better interviewers on radio. Anyway, he interviewed Clayton Dumont, a Klamath Tribal Council member. I think you heard that program as well, which is just tears me up hearing. Well, he's just so, and it's just so many Native people, you know, activists, writers, just regular folks who you hear are so, despite everything, are so, I don't know, kind of calm spoken, you know, not there's also a lot of obviously a lot of anger and rage and whatever, but it just, when you're just talking about what's happening, he just has such a sort of a judicious view based upon his, you know, his grounded in the history. And I guess he's had to, you know, Native people have had to, you know, just take so much and often not be able to really respond. You're talking about the, you know, the incidences of hate and blowback to the Native community for standing up there in that water crisis. Anyway, Clayton Dumont was just, I was really struck by, you know, how he was saying so incredibly calmly about just laying out that, you know, if you would listen to us back then, if you would listen to us now, you know, maybe we can still, you know, actually, you know, the Native people really did understand how things worked, you know, as they had a really grounding in living there for so long. And you know, if you would let us have exercise our treaty rights, and I know this is something you've talked a lot about, and just the potential for actually combining historical justice and some form of environmental, you know, attempt to bring back some kind of balance. The two just go hand in hand, and here, just hearing the Native voice, which has the show yesterday actually talked to I can't remember who he was, the European American guy who was equally passionate as Clayton Dumont about the situation and equally pointing to the need to listen to the Native voice, the Klamath voice and the other voices there to redress and pointing at the need to respect the Klamath senior water rights. Anyway, just what are some of your impressions? I think you heard those programs as well.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, the history there of these sorts of sites. I mean, the Klamath River Basin site did get really ugly, has gotten ugly in the past. You know, I think the tribal members have recounted how, you know, they were spat upon and called racial epithets for their water rights. It shows that the, you know, I often say, you know, I've worked a lot on issues of visibility for Native people, and I feel that we are so invisible. You know, I'm a Native woman, you know, and I meet people, and the first thing a lot of Americans say to me is, like, you're the first Native person I've ever met. And I was pretty shocked the first time I heard this. You know, when you're a kid growing up, and even if you're in a mostly white school, the kids don't say that to you. But when you're sort of as an adult being confronted with this question in the 21st century, it seems pretty odd to me. But it is true that we are incredibly invisible. You know, like, there's a lot of Native people have been wearing those hashtagging, you know, something else, because, you know, CNN categorized Native people as something else rather than actually giving us our actual ethnic, our actual, you know, identity. And it's because our political reality is deeply threatening to the rights of colonists, right? And this is really illuminated by these flashpoints of conflict. Whether you're talking about the Klamath River Basin, or you're talking about Standing Rock, or, you know, in previous decades, you know, the fight over the fish in Wisconsin with the sockeye, you know, where this was in the 90s or the 80s, where white people were carrying signs saying, you know, really brutal signs saying, like, save a walleye, you know, kill a pregnant squaw type of stuff, you know, where it's the continuation of Native people, our very existence, which is a threat, right? And of course, this gets back to the issue of, you know, Indian boarding schools, or as they call them in Canada, residential schools, you know, and of course, everyone's been completely hearing about the up to several hundred bodies they found of Indian children who died at these boarding schools, and in Canada and here in the United States. And so, of course, now there's calls to see what's in at Chamawa Indian School here in Oregon, and so it's and there are bodies there that we don't know. I mean, parents were forced to send their children there. Their children were basically kidnapped from them, and then often died, you know, at these boarding schools, and so whether through abuse or neglect or simply being gathered together where they would be exposed to to disease. And so these are all our ancestors, our elders, who we never got to see, and these are Native families that don't exist today. And so this is all tied to, you know, this elimination of Native people politically, because the reason our lives are in danger is because of our rights to the land and the water and the resources that a colony needs to exploit. And so these are all deeply tied together, and it goes back to what I illustrated in my book Standoff, which is examining these exact sort of flashpoints of conflict, looking particularly at Standing Rock and the Malheur Wildlife Refuge Standoff here in Oregon in 2016, is that this is deeply tied to our origin stories of a colonist versus origin stories. Which I also call algorithms, right? Kind of encoded, if-then statements, and it produces certain outcomes, right? And then the origin story of an indigenous people, and how these differ. They have fundamental structural differences to them, and how these create these outcomes that we see today, and why these conflicts exist, and how we can possibly decode these two origin stories in order to change the situation.
Or cultural assumptions, or I'm sure there's lots of ways of talking
about
that.
Cultural assumptions are part of the if-then statement. So
right.
You have a certain belief, that's your cultural assumption. It becomes an if-then statement, creates the algorithm. And so there are assumptions that go into colonialism, right? And these assumptions are very different than the sort of relationship that indigenous people have with the land, which have rules, right? Colonialism involves rights, right, which you often hear them talking about, right? And these are rights of exploitation and dominion, right? And providence and all of these things and progress. And of course, you know, profit. That's a very different relationship, a very different basis of a relationship than what indigenous people have, which is directly with the spirit of the land itself, with the manifestation of the land, that then which they then have to treat with respect. You approach the land with respect. So the land gives you things, and this manifestation, like the white buffalo calf woman, is a very powerful being, and we are supplicants, and she gives us things, and then we make agreements that she requires. So the terms of the relationship are set by the land, not by the demands of exploitation. So this is two very different systems, and this is why they have such different outcomes, you know. And so it's understanding that framework can help us find solutions. And I think that what you see in these different, this historical knowledge of how to live on the land is becoming incredibly far more important today than ever before as we face these really, you know, these wildfire seasons and this drought condition. You know, Native nations, Native communities have experience with living on the land over the long term. Most of these communities in the West have been very short-term communities. They don't have a history of successfully exploiting the land at that level for thousands of years. You know, sometimes only, you know, since World War II or, you know, maybe since the 1870s. It's not a long period of success. And even the farming, the dryland farming that occurred early on, of course, led to the Dust Bowl within 50 years. It was not a successful model. And so learning from Native people and Native nations is very important to succeeding. And I mean, this is taking place in many ways already, which is one, understanding, how to use fire to basically, this was not a wilderness in the sense that it was untouched. It was managed. the whole thing was managed already by indigenous people. Indigenous nations and communities had management techniques to manage the forest, to manage the land, to manage the water. This was all managed. And so this is understanding this information, this knowledge is really important and crucial to the survival of all of our communities. And so I think that this could be a point of coming together rather than division.
Yeah, if unfortunately there's still these so entrenched psychologies and interests whose livelihood and profit, you know, it depends so much on that unequal access to resources, whether it's the water and the Klamath. But so yeah, that would be really interesting. We'll keep an eye on that and continue to follow that story. Let me just reintroduce. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, one of the talk radio shows. It happened from 8 to 9 a.m. weekday mornings here on your community radio station, KBOO. And my co-host on the line is Jacqueline Keeler, a locally based Native journalist and activist, Dakota and Dene. And really glad to have you on a once a month basis. And I know you kind of the initial thing you put out to talk about today, which we didn't really develop too much, but I think we could, certainly in the context of the climate change issue, it seems to loom rather large, is you wanted to talk about, do some follow-up on Deb Haaland as Interior Secretary, the first Native American secretary of any department, I think. There was a vice president. That's right. I'm sorry. Anyway, so yes, she is the first. And what a department to have, the Interior Department. So something that's come up in the news recently is people pushing back on Biden for not following up on his pledge to end oil and gas drilling and leases on public lands, and that there has been no comment thus far from the Department of the Interior. So that I think will develop as a really interesting place to look at how Deb Haaland sort of asserts herself in her role. I don't know if you've heard anything about that. I don't think she's made any public statements about that.
Yeah, I don't think so yet. I haven't really heard anything about that. Other than that, she was questioned, although it's interesting, North Dakota is actually suing the Biden administration for canceling oil and gas leases as well. And he has frozen the sale of new leases there. So, and I don't know. Right now there is a rising price in oil and gas, and I understand that the Saudis and other folks had decided not to increase their gas production, and so the cost of gas is going up. The last thing is that Haaland has said there's no plan right now to ban new oil gas leasing. So that is still happening. I know that in the context of the Klamath River Basin, she was Secretary Haaland was questioned by U.S. Representative Cliff Bentz, and he was seeking. So these farmers, of course, have access to political power, to these white farmers, and so they're demanding a $57 million package in aid and relief for farmers and ranchers, I think we mentioned during the the farmers also have access to groundwater, which they would have to pay to pump, which they just prefer not to do. And so, but they have in the past received money and support to do that. So it's not necessarily, there are alternatives. Of course, groundwater cannot be a permanent source because they would use it up. It takes millions of years to fill those aquifers. But it is a short-term measure. But yeah, but the farmers were, it does call into question long-term whether these things are actually viable or not, this form of.
Well, Clayton Dumont said something very, very striking. I wonder if he'll get further pushback. I imagine he's, possibly immune from that at this point. But he said that they actually do flood irrigation. They just flood the fields, and you can see cows up to their ankles in water, which is just incredibly wasteful. It's just, he called it obscene, that and some of the other ways that they pump water out of the ground. It was good to hear him use some correct language about that. And then the guy who I can't remember, the white guy who was on yesterday, he must be an environmentalist who's been working on this for a couple decades. He talked about I thought about it in relation to that package that you're talking about. There was a bill back in 2002 after the last big go-round about this that happened under the George W. Bush administration, where they did shut off the water then too, and there was a big pushback. And there was a bill in which there was a provisions for buying people's water rights back, maybe even buying their property back. So to give, because he said there's just such incredible peer pressure from in that irrigation community, the whole Klamath Irrigation Project, that there are some people who probably would want to get out of it. They don't want to keep, in this vicious cycle that they're caught in. Some may even, in their heart of hearts, see that the native people have reason and justice on their side, but they just can't speak out, and they should be given the option. And I thought and that bill was killed by, it was passed in the Senate in 2002 and was killed by, I forget the very conservative rural Oregon Republican congressman, whose name I can't remember, who's since retired. He killed it in the House, and that actually would have been a possibility of actually having some resolution of this. The buyout, I'm sure the bill you're talking about is just more pork for people who've already had too much, lived off too much, and probably doesn't include, I imagine, that buyout provision.
Yeah, I have to take a look at that bill. It's Secretary Holland did respond saying that the Interior Department has already, or the Bureau of Reclamation has already committed $15 million in immediate aid through the Klamath Project Drought Response Agency, and another $3 million in technical assistance to tribes for ecosystem activities. So there is money going there. I wonder, I would love to maybe find out more about how the farmers are now responding to the massive fires going on there as well. Their crops were already going to be dying. They might receive aid for the fire as well, but I think, it's quite, I think, we see often we think that the Pacific Northwest would have been a safe place in the midst of climate change, being so wet, but it shows how delicate the balance is that maintains this climate, during the heat wave, I think what's the final count now, almost close to 100 people died here in Oregon and in Canada, in British Columbia, in that small town of Lytton, 90% of the community was burned down. And this was after they had reached 120 degrees, 121, just a little over 121 degrees Fahrenheit for days. And this is in British Columbia. These are extraordinary temperatures. And of course, here in Oregon, we had temperatures up to 115. These are it's
scary. I mean, the not just the thought of it. I'm scared on a regular basis about our prospects under climate change, and I struggle actually to That's why I had three shows on it. I struggle how to even talk about it. And so I have this venue, and so I'll try to do that some. But it was just scary to me just being out in that heat. I mean, anyway, it's should be a huge, massive wake-up call. But as we know, we're still caught in these insane culture wars and political divisions and all, which are inhibiting our ability. I see we do have a caller. I hadn't even given out the number yet, which I should have. It's since this isn't a listener call, this is a listener call-in show. It's 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. So let's go to our first caller. Who's this?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, this is David. How are you this morning, Paul?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. We had a conversation a couple of weeks ago on your show, and I really enjoyed that. And I enjoy the programming that you're putting out regarding climate change and what we're talking about. I apologize up front. I didn't catch your guest's name because I didn't come in on the show at the very beginning.
Jacqueline Keeler.
Hi, Jacqueline. Thank you for coming on and talking about what's going on in the Klamath Basin. What I wanted to bring up was, thanks to our friend at Counterpunch, Jeffrey St. Clair, and his weekly blog of news bits, over at Counterpunch. A couple of articles came to my attention that I was wondering if you might be able to comment on. There was an article recently in the Sacramento Bee reporting that California officials are warning that nearly all salmon could die off in the Sacramento River this year. And there's a threat that they're going to have to shut down fisheries up and down the entire West Coast. They're going to have to be shut down in 3 to 4 years. And a similar story up in Canada published similar information from a publication called TerraStandard.com. Apparently, the Minister of Fisheries, Oceans, and the Canadian Coast Guard, Bernadette Jordan, was quoted as saying, what cannot be debated is that most wild Pacific salmon stocks continue to decline at unprecedented rates. We are pulling the emergency brake to give these salmon populations the best chance at survival, end quote. They've already shut down 79 coastal fisheries up there. So I'm wondering how this ties into what's going on in the Klamath Basin and whether or not the issue is being addressed at this point. And I'll hang up and take my answer offline. Thank you.
Paul, do you want to address that? Or?
It's all so big, you know. I always have to say I never profess to be an expert at much of anything, and yeah, I mean the dams have to come down. I mean, well, I guess my response to all this is like, you know, we really don't know what's coming at us yet, and it's coming at us really fast. It's getting really bad. It's going to get worse. We don't know. You know, you sent me an article about, you know, a billion sea creatures killed in the ocean. Yeah, I mean it's a holocaust going on. It's an apocalypse. I mean, really. I mean, we have to. So, you know, to the extent that we can do things, we have. You know, we should at least take away some of the biggest impediments. While we still have, I mean, I hate to talk like this, while we still have some, you know, some capacity to use our vast technological resources, you know, we should take down the dams. You know, that's the big thing in the Klamath. If they already came to an agreement, they're supposed to take down two or three dams, you know, the Lower Snake River dams. We should take down some of these dams to at least give some fighting chance to some sort of adaptation. You know, maybe even adaptation isn't possible. I really do hate to talk like this, but to give the natural world, a fighting chance to adapt, that's the key. It's the more things we can do to help adaptation is the better. And anyway, so yeah, that's about my only response to that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's good to hear Paulette Jordan, you know, using her voice to speak on these issues, which are so important, to her people and to the salmon population. Of course, taking down the dams has been, a demand that tribes have been making for decades now. and have limited success. And I think that this is where it comes to this. You know, you were saying how it just seems impossible for people of a certain mindset, right, to be able to respond in a logical way to our situation. And you know, I think that when we were children, we heard about climate change. I think then it was called with the greenhouse effect or something, and it was pretty obvious what needed to happen. You know, even back in the 80s and 90s, it was even the 70s. It was very obvious what needed to be done, and there was consensus, and there still is scientific consensus on this issue. But it has become a political point. And also a cultural power point. I think what we see, and you see this happening, in Texas with the voting to, trying to limit voting rights, happening across the country in different state legislatures to prevent, voters of color from voting. And of course, voters of color take issues like climate change much more seriously. And so this climate change denial, this inability for America to the wealthiest country in the world to marshal its resources, right, to really take this on using, all the knowledge that we have and the ingenuity that we could marshal, the impediment to this is white supremacy, right? This is the impediment. And this goes again to the origin story of colonists. We need to, how do we address this, right? Sometimes knowledge is not in itself power, right? We have a framework that can help us analyze the situation, but actually enacting it, like with climate change, can be problematic or even impossible, right? Because the other paradigm facing this, of course, is the paradigm of colonial extraction and wealth, right? The garnering of wealth, which created this country. And so these are two very different things. I think that the solution, and I've mentioned this on your show before, has to be a reorganization of our political situation, because it's from the political situation that our ideas come from. So, someone who is a white voter, when 9 out of 10 white men with high school diplomas vote for Trump, right, this is not an issue, a personal issue. This is an issue that is structural, right? And so how do we change the structure so that people can come to different conclusions, right? So I think that what needs to happen and to be able to tap into the knowledge and resources of indigenous communities of how to live on this land long term, not just over a short term, right? Long term. And also, to partner it with the with the scientific and technical knowledge and financial wealth of the colonial state, right, that occupies this land. How do we make those two partners? How do we make that happen? And I think that the only way we can make that happen is a political relationship between two equal sovereigns, right? That then and that respects each other and that that advocates for each other, so that all the power of the U.S. government would be used to advocate and to politically recognize an indigenous federal government. And this is really, I think, illustrated in a really famous wampum. My husband is Iroquois. His grandfather was the Bear Clan chief, Mohawk Bear Clan chief at Six Nations. His great grandfather was the Pine Tree chief of the Seneca tribe up in Six Nations. And of course, he's a descendant of Chief Joseph Brant, who led the fight against the colonists during the Revolutionary War with the Iroquois Confederacy. But they have this really amazing wampum. Wampum, if your audiences know, are, they're beaded. White shell I don't know what you call beaded things, and they basically are agreements. They're like a form of writing, right, and symbology. And then this one is called the Two Rose Wampum, and it shows an agreement that the two, that the Iroquois Confederacy and the colonists would exist side by side, but never cross, really. They'd have this, they would each travel their path side by side, but in respect with each other. And this is really what we need. We need a political rearrangement that can allow a real voice at the table for Native people and Native ideas of how to live on the land, and coupled with, you know, the colonial state's, you know, technological and financial apparatus. So I think that, and when you have this different political arrangement, then you will see that the future generations that grow up within that new system are able to think about the world in different ways. Right now we have this colonial system that is obviously raising people, particularly people who regard themselves as white, in a way that makes them incapable of understanding the situation at hand and acting upon it logically.
Yeah, I always, I mean, I fear that the, as I guess I repeatedly pointed out, asserted on my, in the last few weeks, is that my issue is just the time factor is, you know, and I know none of us have control over time. I think some people think they do. And then we got these billionaires in space, which is another subject, but anyway, which we could talk about, but, yeah. But the time, yeah, I mean, I just, things need to happen fast, but, none of us have much control over that. But I do think that, I guess where I would add is the groups who are, you know, who claim to be, you know, more woke, one hates to use that word because of the way the right wing is now using it and the whole critical race theory insanity. But the people who, you know, who are activists, who are, you know, organizations, who they need to maybe, you know, be on the forefront, you know, and I know there's been some development, some growth, some quote progress along those lines. There's been people who've, you know, had more, their consciousness raised more to some extent regarding the issues you're talking about. But I think that needs to happen way, way more. That's a big issue. Another I should have talked about. I know you have had criticisms of the way the Standing Rock and other issues have played out along those lines, but we do have a caller who may have continued waiting for a long time. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi. I'm listening to this conversation, and it's this thing about logic that I've heard come up more than once. And recently, there was a lawsuit from white farmers against the policy by the government to correct some of the discriminations that had happened against black farmers. And one of the foundations of the white farmers' arguments is that this policy is discriminatory, but nowhere did I hear that this is truly a policy about correcting the fact that white farmers were protected at the expense of African-American farmers. And I'm wondering, and I've also heard this with respect to water rights and protecting certain fish in Klamath and so on and so forth, and it just baffles me that we are having this conversation that when it was about protecting white ranchers, white farmers, or white communities, it's perfectly okay. But when we do something to correct this legacy of white supremacy, we are now discriminating against the very people who discriminated against others. And I'm wondering how we have this conversation to somehow inject that logic into the fact that how do we correct the legacy of racism if we cannot create policy to prevent it?
Yeah. Do you want to approach that, Paul?
Or? No, that's all handed. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is, you know, I think it's very interesting. I was thinking about this the other day about how, you know, my paradigm for fixing this vis-a-vis the indigenous nations that preexisted the U.S. and are being occupied by them is different, is really a different analysis than what the black Americans face today, right? It's because something I read right after Ferguson, or I reread it, I was in a writing retreat and at Ferguson it happened, and I was looking at the fact that black Americans living in a black majority city in Missouri in the, you know, 21st century still had no, they were living under basically a police state that was exploiting and victimizing them and incarcerating them and imprisoning them, criminalizing them for the most minor things. And we're basically being overseen by a white city council that was, you know, rubber stamping this. And it just showed the way in which the system is still so, you know, and obviously things are better than they were in the 50s and stuff before the Civil Rights Movement and the gains, including the Voting Rights Act, which has been chipped away further in the latest Supreme Court decisions. And, it's interesting. So I reread my grandmother's cousin, his name was Vine Deloria Jr., and he was a Standing Rock Sioux tribal member and also a historian and author of Custer Died for Your Sins, an Indian Manifesto, which was came out in 1969 and kind of the Bible for Native people during the Red Power Movement of the 70s. And I reread his chapter called The Red and the Black, and it's a very interesting analysis. At the time when I read it, I was pretty resistant to it. I was like, what? Because he was claiming that, he was there in the 60s in Washington, D.C. as the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, right? And he was explaining why the Indian leaders at the time did not want to participate in the civil rights march, that happened in Washington, D.C. And he said it was because the tribes were not interested in civil rights in the white man's system. What they were interested in was, political sovereignty, tribal sovereignty, right? And their critique, and he was explaining their critique of the civil rights movement in that they fundamentally believed that the white people would never really allow Black people real civil rights, equality within their system. It's a white supremacist system, right? And that what they really thought was far more a better analysis was that done by Black nationalists, right? And these are, you have to realize these Indian leaders were old, 50-year-old, 60-year-old white Indian men, mostly some Indian women, of that generation. They grew up in the 20th century, early to mid 20th century, and they were looking at Black nationalism as a far more cogent solution. And because the issue is protection of your rights, and that this is not playing out as we thought it would. In the in the 70s and even 80s under Reagan, or seemed it was happening in the 90s under Clinton, that somehow progress was being made. But when you look at the percentage of representation by Black Americans in so many fields, it's quite low. I mean, I think we discussed this last time, which was they gave a release of how many medical students were Black and Native. And it's gone down since the 90s. I mean, by 30 or 40%, the number of medical students. And so we are not making progress. We're actually, going backwards. And so there's a lot to be said. So this is I have to analyze that a lot more, but because, of course, I haven't written a book about it, and I have written a book about analyzing the political situation between Indigenous people and the white colonial state. But I think that it would be very interesting. I mean, to see. I think, how do you protect your people? How do you protect your community from the trepidations and the terror and the viciousness of the white supremacist system? How do you do that? And I think that's the question. Right now we have had a Black president. Our vice president is Black and Indian from India, and so there is progress. But then, how do we maintain that politically? Because of course, even as Biden and Harris are in office, trying to quickly undo a lot of the damage done in the last 4 years, the Republican, the white Republican, the Republicans are basically the party of white supremacy. Are busy at the state level. The Supreme Court has refused to review the state legislature's actions regarding you know, changing, you know, voting, you know, things that would have been, you know, overseen by the Voting Rights Act. And we are looking at a next election in which, you know, these machinations may actually bring back another Republican, wave. And because, you know, land has greater votes than people. So, you know, these rural areas have a far outsized political footprint in D.C. than you know, large multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial communities, you know, like Los Angeles and New York do, right? And so it's a structural problem once again. And but I have to do, I've probably a lot of Black thinkers have really put a lot of thought into how this could take place.
Well, I know we've talked about finding someone locally, to carry that perspective and have a conversation. I don't know. Maybe this isn't the time to put that out, but I those kind of conversations, I guess I'd like to see more of those kind of conversations. I think you'd be one good person to do that. So yeah, let's just put that out there. But before you go on, looks like we have two callers. We may only be able to take one of them. We've got Marilyn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I just saw a letter in the Oregonian from some kind of Idaho land grab group that wants to take over Eastern Oregon and give it to Idaho. And yes, these are the white supremacists. And yes, they're very bold and aggressive. And we really need to get rid of them. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Well, let's just go to our last caller, since that was sweet, short and sweet. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. This is Jen. I just really appreciate your show, and I so appreciate Declan Keeler when you come on. I've got your book. I still haven't read it. I want to. I'm going to. I just, what you say is just so right on. And I wanted to ask, with, you know, what you were saying about how we need a political rearrangement that allows, you know, the real voice, the table of the indigenous, can Deb Haaland be of help right now in that aspect? I'm also really concerned about what's happening with Line 3 and them pushing through, you know, through Native treaty rights that are just violating.
Okay, thank you. We only have like a couple minutes, so you get the last word, Jacqueline.
Yeah, I have a lot of, I don't know, I still think that Deb Haaland is doing a great job. The secretary is really, I think she has a very, once again, you know, we're not, right, you know, we don't have a federal indigenous government that is a direct partner and equal to the colonial government. So she is actually part of the colonial apparatus, right? But I believe she's doing a good job sort of walking that pretty carefully. And so I hope everything goes well. Of course, my concern is, the kind of pushback she might get, and particularly from, armed right insurrectionists who are making the federal colonial government that she is a part of kind of in their, you know, in their crosshairs. And so I am concerned. With Line 3, I've been speaking a lot to the local tribes there, and they have a slightly different perspective, than I think what is generally reported. And so I'm trying to drill down a bit on that. I'm hopeful. I mean, I should say, though, as a Dakota, you know, those Ojibwe stole the wild rice from us with French guns.
All right, bringing up old yeah. issues here, Jacqueline.
Not that old, yeah, yeah, not that old. So, 19th century, not that long ago.
So. fair enough. Okay. But anyway, on that note, it'll be interesting. I'm sure we'll continue to talk about Deb Haaland. It'd be interesting if you could actually, I guess the possibility of you getting a direct line to her is certainly a lot more difficult than it was a couple of years ago for you. But I don't know if you've even tried to get through. It'd be interesting. I don't know if you could maybe just email questions. Anyway, that's something
I've interviewed her before.
I know
yeah,
that.
In person. Yeah. So, yeah, I will definitely, yeah. and I know some of her staff, so I'll definitely be seeking comment on things. But yeah, she's I think she's doing a great job.
Okay. On that note, thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host. And this is Paul Rowland signing off for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you, Ty, for operating the board. And go KBOO, back live in the studio. Nice. See ya.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damage?
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. KBOO.FM on the web. The time is 8:59 a.m.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are delighted to present the 41st Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival.